From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The status of women in Islamic countries and the U.S. Hello again, I'm Aaron Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A Bangladeshi woman was hounded out of her country for comments about the Quran and women's rights. Now she's had death threats from Muslims in India. In Saudi Arabia, a rape victim's sentence of 200 lashes has inspired international outrage. Is misogyny enshrined in Islamic law? What about the United States, where a woman running for president faces abusive attacks based on gender as well as legitimate policy questions? On To the Point, we'll look at attitudes toward women in religion and culture. On Reporter's Notebook later on, after elections, what's the state of democracy in Venezuela and Russia? First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Saudi Arabian judges will review the case of a rape victim sentenced to 200 lashes. Is misogyny part of Islamic law? In the U.S., a woman can run for president, but not without a misogynistic attack on the Internet. Many misogynistic attacks on the Internet and on the campaign trail. On To the Point, attitudes toward women and how they're shaped by religion and culture. On Reporter's Notebook, Putin wins, Chavez loses. We'll look at elections in Russia and Venezuela. First is news update. The consensus of all 16 of America's intelligence agencies is Iran halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003. The latest national intelligence estimate says that the program remains on hold. Robert Drogan reports on intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
Based on past intelligence estimates, there's been talk of invading Iran because of its nuclear plans. How does this national intelligence estimate differ from those?
Well, this is the first we've seen in 2 years, and the previous estimate back in 2005 assessed with high confidence that Iran was determined to develop nuclear weapons despite its international obligations and despite international pressure. Whereas the new one judges with high confidence, that is the same degree of confidence that in the fall of 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program. They're saying that the halt has lasted for several years, and there's some dispute, some dissension within the. This is a very deliberative process. How these national intelligence estimates are reached, and there was some question. The Department of Energy and the National Intelligence Council have sort of less confidence, moderate confidence that the halt represents a complete halt, but that's where they're standing on it. So it's a real change.
Is it a surprise that the Bush administration, which has been very hawkish toward Iran, released it at all?
Well, the intelligence community is supposedly an independent arm here. There's a reason they put the CIA over across the river as opposed to in the Oval Office. It has, a good deal of credibility on the line on something like this. Obviously, it has a good deal of credibility to gain back after the fiasco going into Iraq. So my guess is that they're trying to stake out a territory here and say, hey, this is what we believe, and, we're going to say it publicly.
Intelligence agencies, of course, known more for their failures of late than they have been for their successes. So you're suggesting there's a lot at stake. They probably wouldn't have said this if they weren't very, very sure of it.
It would seem so. I mean, because it is a big change. I mean, part of the problem here is that the International Atomic Energy Agency, as you know, based in Vienna, the UN watchdog agency, has been going into Iran regularly now for the last several years. The Iranians complain they're the most inspected country in history. They've certainly looked at every site that the Iranians have declared, that is, that they've allowed the weapons inspectors go into. The fear has been that there was some kind of secret program, a redundant program, in which they were hiding facilities. And what this estimate seems to be suggesting is that there's less fear of that. There's less concern of that. What that means for, in the political landscape remains to be seen.
Why does the intelligence estimate say Iran halted its efforts?
I don't see that in here. Why it did that. I have heard other people say, that in 2003, if you remember your date, shortly after the invasion of Iraq, if you remember in the 1980s, Iran and Iraq fought and there was seemed to be a change in the world attitude. And certainly there has been some speculation prior to this that the Iranians looked at that at that point and said, okay, let's figure out what we got here and let's reconsider. The problem has been, and they began to cooperate in around that time.
What about sanctions?
Well, the sanctions have had, you know, it's hard to know. There have been two rounds of sanctions at the UN. There's a threat of another round of sanctions. The last report that the International Atomic Energy Agency put out a couple of weeks ago said the Iranians now have achieved 3,000, have built 3,000 centrifuges. That, in theory, gives them the operating capacity to produce highly enriched uraniums at a sufficient degree that it could produce enough for a bomb in, you know, a year or two. But the centrifuges aren't spinning at the right speed. You know, there are all kinds of technical problems in the program. And the Iranians have said all along through this period that they are simply trying to get peaceful nuclear power. They're trying to get, you know, power plants going, electrical power, just as we have and dozens of countries have around the world. So the debate has always been, or the fear has always been, that that was a cover for a military program. And this report today seems to put the kibosh on that, at least for now.
All right. Speaking of spin, it'll be very interesting to see how the administration reacts, what happens, for example, when the Israelis are asked about their views. They have intelligence on all of this, too. And let us not forget that President Bush has used the phrase World War III in the context of Iran having a nuclear weapon. Bob Dronin, thanks a lot, as always, for being with us.
My pleasure, Warren. Nice to talk to you.
Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, again, covers national security and intelligence. Bob Drogan. In a moment, the status of women in Islamic countries and the U.S. on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. At last week's Middle East Peace Conference in Annapolis, Saudi Arabia's Foreign Minister, Prince Saud Al-Faisal, faced a barrage of questions about an incident that's aroused international outrage, and not just international, but in Saudi Arabia itself as well. He promised the courts will review the sentence of 200 lashes for a 20-year-old woman who was raped, along with a male companion, by seven men. Farida Deef is Egyptian-born. She is Middle East and North Africa researcher for the Women's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. Currently, she is in Egypt, looking into unequal access to divorce for Egyptian women. Farida Deef, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's very briefly review. I think our listeners are familiar with it, but just in case they don't remember the circumstances of this case, a young woman and a man who were not related were found together in a car. Seven men attacked them, once again, raped them both. Subsequently, they were sentenced for their crimes, and so was she, initially to 90 lashes. Let's start there. What was the justification for 90 lashes?
Well, both her and the man that accompanied her in the car were sentenced 90 lashes for what they call khilwa, which is illegal mingling, because for being in the car with someone who was unrelated to her. And the rapists themselves only received very minor penalties for abduction, because the courts wouldn't admit videotape evidence from a cell phone that proved that they had sort of very violently raped both of them. And so the courts very clearly, very much focused on the illegal mingling aspect of this case. They sentenced her to 90 lashes when, in fact, it is a crime. She didn't admit that she had, she was in the car with someone who was not her relative. But clearly, the prosecution could have used a certain degree of discretion, especially in this case, not to pursue a very minor charge of illegal mingling when you're talking about a case that, is a very violent gang rape case, and that should be the sort of priority of the courts. But in fact, what you see from the Ministry of Justice's website and the information that they've disseminated is that they're much more preoccupied with the illegal mingling charges than they are with the actual rape. And in fact, they blame her for it.
Now, not only did they blame it for her for it, but when she and her lawyer went public, the sentence was actually increased to 200 lashes. You have met the woman involved. Tell us about her, who she is, where she came from, and how she views this.
She's a very young woman. When I met her, she was 19 years old, and she's from the Qatif region, which is in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. She is extremely quiet, very distraught by the whole ordeal, understandably, really has lost a lot of faith in this system. She was going to pursue charges, again, extremely rare, that a woman would actually report sexual violence in Saudi Arabia, would report any kind of violence, would actually, take it all the way to the court, and hire a lawyer. All of those things were extremely rare. And in fact, what she saw, very unfortunately, in the courts is that she was very much, blamed for it. That actually she had to deal with very severe consequences for actually trying to get justice in her case. And the way the courts dealt with it was sort of astonishing. I mean, we've heard all sorts of stories about the way the judiciary is sort of very adverse to women's rights in Saudi Arabia. But, I mean, this case, I think, is particularly appalling and kind of shows in a very clear way how arbitrary the system is. You know, the fact that the judiciary, increased her sentence just very simply because she was thought to be trying to influence the judiciary through the media by being vocal, sort of in an attempt to silence her. The fact that they could just confiscate her lawyer's license and bar him from the case, that they never actually even gave the lawyer the initial verdict. I mean, he's still trying to get the verdict in order to, establish his appeal. In every way, this case has demonstrated how arbitrary the system is, I think, for all Saudis, but I think in particular for women, and in particular for women who are actually trying, to get justice in the system and for sexual violence crimes.
I understand that there is no law on sentencing in Saudi Arabia, so that the judges can, as you indicated, do pretty much anything they want. In this respect and in others, is Saudi Arabia very different from other Muslim countries?
Extremely different, in the sense that, other countries do have penal laws. I mean, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a written penal law, and so, as you said, judges have complete discretion, and so a judge in the eastern province might rule on the very exact case in a very different way than a judge in Riyadh. And, we've seen cases reported in the press and otherwise that, where, individuals who were, charged with sexual harassment received much harsher penalties than the rapist in this actual case. And so that's been appalling. I mean, that for sexual harassment, you could receive the same charges that you do in this case. And I think it just demonstrates kind of how the fact that she was in this car with this man really influenced the judges, in their assessment of this case. And, when I spoke to her, she talked to me about how when she was in the courtroom, the way they treated her and the way the judges would ask her, would yell at her, would say that she was a liar because she didn't know exactly the dates in which things occurred or she couldn't remember the exact dates. They asked her why she had even left the house without her husband's permission. All of these things, trying to really very much blame her for the sexual violence that she felt.
Farah Dedif, again, in Egypt at the moment, for Women's Rights, for Human Rights Watch. Laleh Bakhtiar is in-house scholar for Qazi Publications. That's a 35-year-old Muslim publisher based in Chicago. She's author of many books about Islam and women's rights, and she has been a translator of the Quran. I believe she is the first American woman to have that distinction. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
What about the Quran in this respect? Since this incident became public, became an international incident, many people have said that it is due to misogyny within the Quran itself. What do you say?
Well, actually, there's nothing in the Quran that says that what the punishment of someone would be. But the Quran does, there's, of course, a difference of opinions, but that it does ask for women to cover and also for men to lower their eyes when they're with women believers. But, for instance, in other countries like Malaysia or Indonesia or Iran, there's no such law that a woman cannot be in a car alone with another man who she's not related to. There is no such law. In Tehran, I myself was in many taxi cabs where I would just be in the cab with the driver. And so this is an outrageous law that Saudi Arabia, which is the most autocratic of Middle Eastern governments, has, you know, then they don't even have a penal system, as I just heard. So it's an outrageous, a grievous against this woman, and certainly shows injustice.
Is the Quran discriminatory against women in the sense that we mean that here in the United States?
Well, women, not in the—actually, the Quran gave women a lot more rights than they had in previous—before Islam. And there are many rights that are given to women in the Quran. One of the problems is that the way the Quran has been interpreted, it's not the Quran itself, it's not the Arabic of the Quran, but the way it has been interpreted then is undermines women's rights.
Back to Farah Dadif, you're in Egypt looking into unequal access to divorce for Egyptian women there. Is it contended in Egypt that that comes from the Quran, or is that something special to that country?
Well, I mean, I think it's, I think governments will often use a variety of excuses. They will say it is the Quran, you know, Sharia tells us that, you know, that a man can divorce his wife quite easily and that a woman needs to go through a whole process and provide evidence of harm in order to divorce her husband. But other times they'll use the sort of excuse of culture, and sort of our culture is not yet ready for, you know, women to have a very sort of easy time in the divorce process. And so there's a variety of excuses that are used, and there's clearly a very selective use of Sharia as well. I mean, throughout the region, people are not using Sharia-based laws in terms of sort of financial dealings or in terms of the civil administration of the country, but they use Sharia, and they very, or at least say they're using Sharia when they're talking about sort of criminal penalties in some cases, and also in particular when they're talking about family laws, because you know, by applying Sharia in the family realm, people are allowed, you know, the government is allowing a sort of the same kind of very specific gender roles to be perpetuated, you know, to have women on a very second class footing with, you know, as compared to men within the family and within society, and they just are able to kind of perpetuate that power dynamic. And so I think it's a very sort of selective and opportunistic use of religion oftentimes. I think, I mean, the problem in Saudi Arabia as well is that you're talking about a situation in which the Wahhabi thinking, which is sort of the main crux of the thinking, and especially, you know, very prominent within the judiciary, takes religious texts literally. They don't believe, you know, for the most part, in kind of, you know, analyzing the sort of present situation, the present circumstances, in order to sort of determine whether or not the penalty as prescribed in Sharia is still relevant for today. It really is just a very literal interpretation and a sort of a literal reading of the religious text, which I think if you read any religious text sort of literally, I think, you know, I think women are in a very bad footing. I also think that, you know, homosexuals are in a very bad footing, religious minorities as well.
Okay.
And you've structured a whole country around a very literal interpretation and reading of religious texts, and that's where you see a number of human rights abuses, just, in particular with respect to women.
Just quickly, if I may, are you yourself Muslim?
Yes, I am.
And Laleh Bakhtiar, back to you, our translator, yes, of the Quran. You too, I take it, are Muslim.
Yes.
What is Farida Deef right about literal translation of the Quran, or is there something more going on? You said that it, in fact, provides more rights for women than they had before the Quran.
Yes. No, I agree completely with her. Particularly in Saudi Arabia, and their perspective and their Islamic law, their Sharia, they do only believe in the literal interpretation, and that there is. They don't believe that there's any meaning behind a form. It's just the form only. So it is a problem when they do a literal interpretation and then go to the Sharia, which then they misuse, just as she said. I mean, she's explained it very clearly, and that's exactly how it happens. There are other countries that are not literal in their interpretations, and so in some areas women have other rights. But again, women are basically still second-class citizens, as they are, you know, as many religions have throughout history placed women in that role. It's just today, in the last, say, I would say 20 years, that more women are speaking out and are getting educated, are learning the Sharia themselves, so that they can, hopefully at some point, be able to issue edicts and be able to stand up for themselves. Because, you know, rights are something that you have to take. No one is going to hand them to you on a silver platter.
Bernard Haykel is professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He's author of the book Revival and Reform in Islam. He has a forthcoming book on the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia. Once again, we just heard that Wahhabism is one of the reasons that Saudi Arabia is such a different place, legally and otherwise, from other Muslim countries. Professor, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
What's your take on the differences between the rights of men and women in the Quran itself?
Well, I mean, both your earlier speakers mentioned that the interpretation that's practiced in Saudi Arabia is a literal one. And so therefore, clearly, if you have a literal reading of the Quran, you would come out with a highly gendered view of how society should be organized. And so these Wahhabi clerics in Saudi Arabia are not sort of producing their opinions out of thin air. In fact, they claim and they are basing themselves on texts, on religious texts, not just the Quran, by the way, because Islamic law is not just about the Quran. It's also about the traditions of the Prophet, the historical practice of the Muslim community, the consensus of the jurists over time, and so on. So that to argue that somehow Wahhabism is bizarre or completely sort of from outer space is simply wrong. Now, clearly, Islamic law is a contested field, and there are people like one of your speakers who's trying to interpret it differently, and, you know, God bless her and more power to her. I hope that more Muslims come to her point of view. But the Wahhabis are not sort of from outer space.
What about the difference between illegal mingling, which we heard was so important to
right.
the judges in Saudi Arabia,
right.
And other crimes such as rape?
Well, there are two things that are happening here in this case, as far as I can see. One is that, you know, there is this issue of khalwa, a very strong injunction in the Saudi interpretation of Islamic law that does not permit unrelated men and women to be together. And the reason for that is that they assume that if a man and a woman who are unrelated are together, these people will sleep with each other. And therefore, you would have a situation where children are produced out of wedlock, and that would spell sort of chaos for the society, because children won't know who their fathers and mothers are necessarily. So, you know, these arguments are rooted in specific values, social values, patriarchal values that are prevalent in Saudi society. And those values will trump the question of rape, because in the case of rape, the analogy is made to adultery, and here you have a very high standard of evidence in Islamic law, Wahhabi or non-Wahhabi, all Islamic law says that you need four male witnesses to the act of rape, and that's nearly impossible to prove.
Okay. Bernard Haykel, again, at Princeton University. We're going to continue this conversation after we take a very brief break on Reporter's Notebook. After controversial elections, what's the state of democracy in Venezuela and Russia? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking about misogyny today, hatred of women in religion and in different cultures, which may have the same religion. One of our guests, Bernard Haykel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University and author of Revival and Reform in Islam. What about the fact that in some Muslim countries, most conspicuously Pakistan, where the prime minister has been a woman twice, we have had women rise to positions of leadership? What does that have to do with the kinds of distinctions that you say are inherent in Sharia law, whether it comes from the Quran or other sources?
Well, I mean, the example you give, and it's an example, by the way, that's prevalent in every South Asian country, whether it's Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, or Sri Lanka, for that matter. Each of these countries has had a woman leader, and very often that has nothing to do with Islam, and has more to do with the political context of these countries. Often these leaders, these women leaders, are daughters of very prominent politicians who waged the campaigns against colonial rule. And you would not have that happen in any Arab country that I know of, because for precisely the point that in Islamic law, according to, let's say, the Wahhabi interpretation and the dominant Arab interpretation of Islamic law, a woman cannot lead men. It's not acceptable.
Why is it acceptable then in other countries, even though they're based on the same religion?
I think because they don't apply Islamic law when it comes to matters of public law and constitutional law. They simply consider Islamic law to be in abeyance on these issues.
So it's just a question then of discretion and choice.
Right, and it's selective choosing of what you want to apply and not. I mean, for instance, Muslims in Islamic law, you have a lot of law on slavery, that slavery is permitted. Of course, it's also circumscribed and it has rules and regulations. But most Muslims, with a couple of exceptions, most Muslim countries do not apply the laws of slavery and do not practice slavery, and that's because Muslims have decided that slavery is no longer an institution they wish to support.
All right, Bernard Haykel, once again, a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. His latest book, Revival and Reform in Islam, and a forthcoming one on the Wahhabis, To Be Expected. Thanks to you. Thanks to Laleh Bakhtiar at Qazi Publications in Chicago, and Farida Deef, who is currently in Egypt as Middle East and North Africa researcher for the Women's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. In the United States, women were not given the right to vote until 1920. Current law, of course, allows a woman to be elected president, but Hillary Clinton's the first to have a real chance. Misogyny, however, is by no means dead. Here are some of the Facebook headlines that we can read on the air. Most of them, or many of them, we simply cannot. Hillary Clinton shouldn't run for president. She should just run the dishes. Hillary Clinton, stop running for president and make me a sandwich. I want to smack Hillary Clinton. I want to hit Hillary Clinton in the face with a battle axe. Life's a bitch. Why vote for one? Jonathan Tylove is national correspondent for Newhouse News Service and follows politics and the Internet. Recently wrote the article, Hillary Hatred Finds Its Misogynistic Voice. Jonathan Tylove, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Gets a lot worse than that.
Yeah. No, those were the safer places to go. And I guess I was surprised by the depth and volume of it, and how freely it's expressed. I mean, the ones you mentioned were from Facebook, which has about 20 million people on it, mostly high school and college, but beyond, to the chagrin of my children, I joined so I could have access to this and communicate with these folks. And, you know, as I mentioned, as I wrote in this story, if you start going through the thickly settled provinces of anti-Hillary land on the web, you're soon knee-deep in bitch, slut, skank, whore, and ultimately the C word, which I've seen many more times in the last couple of weeks than I had ever imagined I would see.
We've had a lot of women leaders in this country. We've had governors. We've had U.S. senators. We have the first woman Speaker of the House. Do they cause the same kinds of vile language to be applied?
I don't think to the same extent, but we really have never been here before on a couple of counts. I mean, Hillary Clinton is a very polarizing figure. She's very well known. She carries her own baggage, but also that of her husband. So there are a lot of people who hate her to start out with. The thing is, though, that people, when they attack a woman, tend to go to these gender-specific slurs where they don't do the same with a man, and they don't have the same impact with a man. There's simply not the same vocabulary for disparaging a man that there is for a woman. And you have a combination of this is the first woman who seriously could become president, and this is the first time you've had a presidential election where the blogosphere is completely in gear, and the boundaries between public and private and what's appropriate where are completely broken down. So, for instance, Facebook, people talk as if they're anonymous, but they're not, in fact, anonymous, and they're not private. It's public groups with thousands of members. They seek to get as many members as they can, and they usually, whereas a lot of the web is anonymous, most of these people have their names and the school they attend, what year they'll graduate, and with a little Googling, you can tell, you know, if they're on the football team and if they write for the school newspaper.
You made the distinction between men and women and the way they are attacked. We have now, arguably, the first black man, I won't call him an African-American, it's much more complicated than that,
right,
to be a president of the United States. Have you not seen the same kind of attacks only on a racist basis against him?
No, you haven't, and that surprised me because previous to this, I was writing about race for the last 15 years, and I initially went looking to see how both Obama as potentially the first black president and Clinton as potentially the first woman president are being treated. And there's simply not the same, there's nothing like the same acrimony directed toward Obama. I think part of it is that he's not, you know, he's a kind of cooler, you know, calmer figure, doesn't provoke the same kind of antagonism, and hasn't been around as long. But I also think that, people know that if you use the N-word instead of the C-word, you've crossed a line. We've established certain social norms, and people just know that they've identified themselves in ways they don't want to be identified if they cross that line. Whereas when I contacted some of these people, they're quite proud of the fact that they can go online and call Hillary Clinton whatever they want.
Again, Jonathan Tylove is national correspondent for Newhouse News Service. Michael Kimmel is professor of sociology at State University of New York, Stony Brook. He's author of Manhood in America, a Cultural History. Professor Kimmel, good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much, Ryan.
You've been listening to all of our conversation here, and I'm very interested in your take on it. Picking up from what we were just discussing with Jonathan Tylove, does this suggest that racism is somehow less basic than misogyny in our culture and religion?
Well, I don't think that racism is any less basic, but I think it is certainly, as Jonathan points out, less permissible. I think that we know when we're saying something that's racist that it's not okay. But sexism is given much freer rein. Look, every single election is a kind of meditation on gender. Not that in the last presidential election we found out that John Kerry spoke French, drank Chardonnay, and ate Brie. He wasn't a real man. The constant efforts to make him not a real man. Hillary, we're finding out, is a real man. That's what the argument that Hillary Clinton is not a real woman is also an argument about her masculinity in a way, that they're trying to make her into a man, basically, a kind of transvestite, cross-dressing political animal.
Is that kind of language used?
Well, of course. Listen to the very things that you yourself quoted. All of them were Hillary Clinton should be back in the kitchen making me a sandwich, doing the dishes. It's interesting. We didn't always hate Hillary Clinton in this country. There's a large number of people. This is very politically motivated. People hated Hillary Clinton when she was promoting health care as the first lady. When that was abandoned and she was the victim of her husband's philandering, people loved her. They were very, oh, she's so, you know, oh, poor thing, she's the victim. Now that she's an independent political person again, She's being vilified. So what does this tell me? This tells me that it's not women that we hate or love, but it's women's independence. It's women's autonomy that we really don't like. Time and again, when we see women, just a couple of weeks ago here in New York, there was this big controversy about the fans at football games harassing women and asking that they show their breasts and all of this sort of stuff. And the response was, if women are there, if women are present, this is what's going to happen to them. It's women's presence that's the problem. And I don't think that's true at all, because the women who take the tickets don't get this. The women who make the food don't get this. The women who serve the beers don't get this. Just women who are there by themselves as fans get this. It's not women's presence. It's women's equality that drives people around the bend.
We started talking about religion, and particularly Islam, on this program. Is this, do you think, true of and basic to other religions as well?
Well, I think this is an important question, because while I'm not qualified as your other speakers were to comment specifically about Islam, I can say that Islam does share with the other monotheistic religions, Judaism and Christianity, a textual denigration of women. You find it in the ancient in the Bible around Judaism as well. I can tell you one great story. Some guy is wandering around this town with his wife one day, and he can't find a place to stay. So this other guy says, "Well, come stay with us. It's okay." So then these neighborhood guys get wind of the fact that this stranger and his wife are staying there, and they come to the house. They knock on the door and they say, "Bring out that guy. We want to rape him." And the host says, "Oh, no, 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 you can't do that. Here, rape my wife instead." They say, "No, no." Then the guest comes out and says, "No, no, don't take his wife. Take mine." So they gang rape his wife, kill her. And this is reported, by the way. I'm not making this up. This is Judges chapter 19. This is a cautionary tale about what life was like before the exodus from Egypt. It's not given as a problem. It's not condemned. How many hundreds of thousands of women were burned as witches under various other kinds of religious, the Christian versions of Sharia law? My argument is that monotheistic religions tend to have male, obviously monotheistic religions have male gods, and they tend to promote the denigration of women textually, not in practice. There's lots and lots of different ways in which people also use the Bible or use monotheistic religious ideas for women's emancipation and liberation. Obviously, people, you know, believe that individuals are have individual souls, equal mind, equal rights, and you can make a religious argument for that as well.
Are there incidents in the New Testament that are similar to the one that you quoted from Judges?
Far fewer. Largely because the message of the New Testament is about mercy.
Okay. So mercy includes women, then, as well as men. They're entitled to it.
Well, yes, and then there's a whole tradition in some parts of Protestant, among some Protestant clergy, about claiming Jesus as a feminist because, after all, he sort of intervenes in favor of Mary Magdalene. He intervenes in various ways in favor of women.
Michael Kimmel, again, professor of sociology at the State University of New York. Jonathan Tylov, quickly back to you with Newhouse News Services. You've been following this for a long time. You've joined Facebook. You've gotten involved in the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing. I'm just very interested in your take on what we heard about the basis for it.
Well, I guess what made me shudder a little bit about looking at this and what Facebook and other things offer you the opportunity to see is sort of a glimpse into people's more private thinking and what they're willing to express in what they think is a sort of more private moment. And it just made me think that we're maybe headed for some pretty ugly days ahead if, in fact, Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, because there's something very deeply embedded in the psyche. And some of it's, you know, adolescent male testosterone and whatever else working itself through, but it's not limited to that. I mean, you'll find these same kind of comments more broadly spread across the blogosphere.
Let me go back to Laleh Bakhtiar again with Qazi Publications, our Muslim publisher and translator of the Quran. I'm just very interested in your take as well on an American woman candidate for a president and the kind of language that's being used about her, and these broader questions as well about the way that women are treated at football games and in other places, depending on the roles that they play and the degree of power and equality that they exhibit.
Yes, I think, you know, your speakers have really said what it is. It's basically that society is not ready yet as a whole, whether it's Islamic society or Christian society or Jewish society or Buddhist society, it doesn't matter what religious tradition a person comes from. They just don't seem to be ready yet to accept women on an equal basis. And in Hillary Clinton's case, it's because she's too intelligent, and they may want to call that a man, but this is part of the Islamic tradition. There are some hadith in the Quranic, in the Sharia law, that says that, you know, women are, you know, the problem with women is that they're not intelligent. So when you do come and have a woman who is intelligent as she is and can equally debate and discuss and, you know, hold her own, then people, men, are threatened by this. And I think it is that adolescent kind of male ego that is being threatened wherever in the world it happens to be, whether you're Saudi or you're, you know, from New York or wherever.
But it seems to be a matter of choice to a certain extent, because, again, we have Bhutto in Pakistan, we have Indira Gandhi in India, we have political leaders in Malaysia and other Islamic countries that are women.
Yes, exactly. But unfortunately, and I think that's what one of your speakers mentioned, is because they were politically, it was their, you know, they put aside Islamic law and they politically allowed them to, whereas here we don't have the problem of the law, and politically it is open to women. But still, society doesn't seem to be ready mm-hmm. to accept women, intelligent women, as leaders. I mean, if she probably looked like Marilyn Monroe, everyone would, or she acted like Marilyn Monroe, everyone would vote for her.
We'll see. We do once again have governors. We have the Speaker of the Congress. We have other American senators and so on. So certainly women have attained to very high levels of politics here in this country, just not the very
Right. Yes.
Professor Kimmel, let me go back to you. What does this all have to do with economics?
Well, there's two different questions before us. There's the question of the reassertion of male domination around the world by certain groups. Certain groups, for example, if you look at where the impulses are coming from in around the world, in the Islamic world particularly, it's coming from the independent shopkeepers, the bazaaris, the small shopkeepers. And this is the group that has been most displaced by globalization. At the same time, as many of these countries, women are newly empowered. They are developing their own mechanisms for economic autonomy. They're going to school, they're going to college, they're going to professional school. And the resentment against women is partly fueled by the economic displacement of these men. I don't think, however, in contrast to what one of your speakers just said, I don't think we need to wait until everybody's ready to have a woman leader. I don't think we had to wait until everyone was ready for integration or for the Civil Rights Act. I think we have to make decisions, and eventually people are going to be grumbling on the internet forever about these sorts of things, but eventually we'll get used to it. I think that most places, most people will be perfectly comfortable when we do have a black president, when we do have a woman president. It's inevitable. It will happen. And it's happened in most of the other places where it's happened are those countries that show up at the top of the gender equality index. The World Economic Forum has an index of all gender equality. And those countries that are at the top of that for gender equality, incidentally, we rank 18th globally, but at the top of that have all had women leaders, have all had women prime ministers, like Britain, for example, or most of them have. And I think it's inevitable.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave it at that. And thank you all very much for being with us. Michael Kimmel, professor at State University of New York, author of Manhood in America, A Cultural History. Lale Bakhtiar at Kazi Publications in Chicago. Jonathan Tylove, national correspondent for Newhouse News Services. And our earlier guests, Bernard Heichel, a professor at Princeton University, and Farida Deef with Human Rights Watch, currently in Egypt. Good to have all of you with us, and thanks very much. Yesterday's elections in Russia and Venezuela were watched around the world for signs of how democracy is faring in those very different countries. In Russia, the results went as expected, but Venezuela saw what can only be called an upset. In a moment, what's next for Vladimir Putin and Hugo Chavez on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Orman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Vladimir Putin and Hugo Chavez were both accused of unfairly using government resources to influence elections that were important to their own political futures. They weren't running themselves, but in both cases, new powers and new influence were at stake. Putin won. Chavez lost. Moises Naim is editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. He was Venezuela's Minister of Trade and Industry before Chavez took power. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you,
Warren. Let's start there. To what extent is this a setback for Hugo Chavez?
It is a setback. Essentially, the Venezuelan people refused to give him a blank check to change the constitution in a way that would allow him to be the only elected official in the country without term limits.
The election was very close, 51-49, something along those lines. President Chavez said he accepts the result. Does that surprise you?
Yes, it was a surprise, but he also said in that same speech that about 4 million Venezuelans that used to support him did not support him and did not vote for this change. And they understood that the constitutional change was essentially one more attempt at concentrating even further the power in his hands.
He has been depicted as such a despot, such a megalomaniac that in other instances, people in his position with that sort of description of them have tried to overturn the results or challenge them in some way or refuse to publicly accept them. Does this suggest that Chavez is perhaps a more benign figure, at least more complex than he's been made out to be?
Yes, it's more complex, and we're living in different times. And also, this was not an election to oust him of power. This was an election. Hmm. He continues to be the president of the country. He can do, and in fact, he said that he can and will do a lot. He will implement a lot of the ideas contained in the constitutional change, regardless. And he has the power to do so. So he will continue to be the president of the country, and essentially try. He said, "I'm not changing one comma of what I proposed, and I will try to implement that set of policies anyway."
Well, those things, though, that he can implement fall more in the category of sweeteners, don't they? The six-hour day and the Social Security retirement for various workers, which it was said initially he could have done himself without a constitutional amendment. What he wanted from the Constitution was greater power.
Exactly. And I think the Venezuelan people called his bluff on this. Everybody understood that it was all of those sweeteners were just distractions from the center. And the only goal, the central goal that he was interested in getting, and that was to be able to continue to be president of the country for life, for all practical purposes. And all the rest were just to try to create distractions about this other central theme.
Again, Moises Naim is editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. Well, what about across the world, Mr. Putin? It is being argued today that, in fact, he did use the government resources in a way that gave him a bigger victory than he should have. But is there any question that he actually won, or his side won in these parliamentary elections?
Well, no, there is no doubt. And what is very interesting is how these two presidents who had elections on the same day, Hugo Chavez and Vladimir Putin, have, even though their countries and they themselves are so different, they have so many similarities. These are presidents that were elected through democratic means, and then after being elected took advantage of a variety of circumstances to concentrate power well beyond what we will normally accept in a democracy. And one of they could do that for two reasons. First is because they were popular and people liked them, or parts of the country liked what they symbolized and what they did. But also is because of high oil prices allowed these oil exporting countries, Russia and Venezuela, to have huge incomes that these presidents could spend at their discretion. And so high oil prices and popularity, high oil prices helped fuel the popularity of this president that then used it to concentrate powers in and create what it's an essentially not the traditional democracy that we understand.
What do you think Mr. Putin is likely to do? He could become prime minister now that his party is totally in control of the Duma. He's indicated that he has that in mind. Or is this just utterly mysterious? Do we really not have any good idea at all of what he's going to do?
Russian observers don't know and are not clear on what will happen. I think the consensus is, however, that President Putin will continue to play a very important role in Russia and in Russia's future, regardless of what form it takes the next election.
Was Putin just more successful at using his office to crush the opposition than Chavez was, or are there other kinds of differences? Was it more difficult in Venezuela to do the sort of thing that Putin did?
Well, no. And in fact, it's quite amazing to see how both governments, despite their popularity and their access to resources, showed great insecurity and had to rely on massive uses of public assets and all sorts of advantages given by the incumbency. And so what's very interesting is to note that these were two different elections. One was a referendum to change the constitution in the case of Venezuela, and the other was a parliamentary election. And so what was being asked of the country were two different things. In both cases, however, abstention was very high. And that shows that the country, the voters in general, were not as engaged as they would have been otherwise.
What's going to happen to either of these people if oil prices drop?
Well, they depend a great deal on their ability, not only that to have access to the oil prices. But also remember that these are two presidents that can spend those resources at their discretion. That checks and balances that we know in public spending in other countries are not present fully in either Russia or Venezuela. So it's not just having access to the oil money, but also the ability to spend it in any way they want.
Isn't Chavez, though, subjected to more checks and balances, excuse me for interrupting, than Putin is?
I'm sorry?
Isn't Chavez subjected to more checks and balances than Putin? Chavez wanted to get rid of him. That's one of the points of the referendum.
No, and that was another of the distractions because there is plenty of evidence that in the last 5 years, Chavez was able to use their Venezuela's oil income as it was his own bank account. And he has started all sorts of initiatives from subsidizing gasoline for Londoners or people in Massachusetts and New York to, bankrolling the Cuban economy without ever having had any way of consulting the Venezuelan people if they wanted their money to be used in that way.
Moises Naim, as always, thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Editor-in-Chief, Foreign Policy Magazine, former official in Venezuela. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.